Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, January 4th, 2024. Happy New Year's, everybody. I'm James Spencer here at Basic Brewing Radio. We're all about home brewing. This week, it's a homebrew roundtable with Desiree and Dave Knott of High Gravity, Steve Wilkes, and me. We talk about the past and present of home brewing, along with a little bit about the future, while sipping some delicious beers from Pippin's Tap Room. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing, and many thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Financial supporters have gotten a link to the DVD commentary that Steve and I did with our original Introduction to Extract Homebrewing DVD. I'll be releasing that to the general public this summer, but I wanted financial supporters and participants in our annual disaster show to have the first look. By the end of the week, I'll also be sending financial supporters an early release of our first Basic Brewing video episode of the year. That's the one on my pre-prohibition American lager, or classic American Pilsner, that Chris Colby and I formulated on this show. That was a delicious beer, and it's all gone as of last night. I do think I have some keg fills in the beer fridge as a backup. My new beer is now in the keg as of a couple of days ago. It's the Oat Malt Stout that Chris Colby and I formulated along with Peter Simons. It didn't turn out as expected, but I think it's going to be a happy accident because it turned out less than 4% ABV, but it tastes great. So I may be entering the new year with an accidentally sessionable, delicious beer. So hard to complain about that. I fermented that beer with A10 Darkness from our friends and sponsors at Imperial Yeast. That's the yeast that Eben from Imperial suggested and then sent to me. He also sent a couple of packs of the current seasonal yeast from Imperial, L25 Huga. This is a yeast that we've used before with great success. It's a Northern European lager yeast famously used in Pilsner-style beers that complements significant hop additions. Clean and crisp with a very light sulfur profile. I kind of want to brew an extract or beer with that. Watching that Introduction to Extract Homebrewing DVD has me kind of itching to go back to basics and, you know, put some malt extract to work. I think that'll be fun. I think it's cool enough in the basement that I can ferment a lager down there without any refrigeration help. But whatever I choose to brew, I know those 200 billion cells in each easy-to-open package of Imperial L25 Huga will be ready to go to work. Imperial yeast even has a recommended shelf life of up to 4 months. So if you want to pick up a couple extra packs, maybe, you can do that. Ask your local homebrew store about L25 Huga from Imperial Yeast and check out all the dependable deliciousness at imperialyeast.com. That's imperialyeast.com. Okay, a few weeks ago, Desiree and Dave came over from Tulsa to pay us a visit. We saw some of the sights of Northwest Arkansas, and they brought us a generous sampler of beers, some of which you can find kits for on highgravitybrew.com. So I thought it would be a great opportunity to start the year off talking to them and to Steve about a whole bunch of stuff. Desiree and Dave, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Good to be here.
And Steve Wilkes, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, guys.
I just said that that my purpose here today is just to drink beer with my friends and start the year out good. talking about beer, talking about home brewing, and just spending time with some good friends that I've known for many years, and our friendship, everybody here, I think, me between each of y'all, our friendship has either started but grown and is kept, you know, more vital by homebrewing. So, you know, there's something to toast for the new year. So cheers. Happy 2024.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
What are we cheersing with?
This is the Driller Light.
It's the lightest beer we make.
Yep. It's our American Light Lager. It's the lightest beer that we make. And I think that Tim, our brewer, does an amazing job with it.
It's from High Gravity Brewing Company in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and it's served in Pippin's Tap Room. if you're around that area. And can you buy it in the stores as well?
Yes, we have it in several liquor stores around town. That's Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's awesome. Delicious. It's really good. So give us the stats on this beer. Is it? I mean, it's called Driller Light.
Now, so if you're not from Oklahoma, you wouldn't know what that means.
We have a mascot for our town. It's the Golden Driller, and mm-hmm. he stands in front of our convention center, and he looks just like the guy on the picture, like an oil field roughneck. And we glommed onto that symbol and.
Yeah, so we, and then, you know, like, we thought it was a cute name, you know, Driller Light, you know, imitating, you know, who, light.
Yeah. So,
Rhymes with yeah. light.
Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about. I wouldn't tell.
Yeah, so it's our lightest beer, and I couldn't give you the super specific stats on it. It's made with
corn and rice.
It's a blend of corn and rice. Along with the Pilsner malt.
Mm. Well, it's you know what the word I'm going to say. It's delicious. It is nice and light, but it's not as light as its sort of rhyming namesake. You know, it actually has some character.
and we do use real hops in the production of this beer, so you have to protect it from the light.
Oh,
the other light beer. Is light stable because they use hop extracts.
Ah, there you go. We hide it from a L-I-G-H-T.
Right.
So what percentage of corn and rice, and I'm assuming that this is the flaked product and or pre-gelatinized product, right?
Right.
It's like close to 10% of each one of those.
Oh.
That order.
Yeah. So 80, 10, 10.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ballpark.
Yeah. And then hops, noble hops.
It's a good question. Yeah. Tim, the brewer is not with us today.
Oh, well, doesn't matter. It's a great beer.
You can just make things up.
Yeah.
That's funny. I actually have I could open up Beersmith and check it out, but.
We're just friends here, and all of your beers are made using Clarity Firm or the commercial equivalent, right?
Right, that's right. Yeah, we gluten reduced beers, all of them. I have celiac, and so we put it in our beer so that I can drink the beer that we make without having any issues.
Now, I made my first beer with Clarity Firm. It's this what Chris Colby and I. Called a pre-prohibition American lager or classic American Pilsner. And I used both Clarity Firm and I used a gelatin in the keg to clear it out. Uh-huh. And it took a while for it to actually become clear. Right now it's, you know, of course the keg's almost gone and it's super bright, it's super clear. But is that, and I used like 20% rice maybe? Flaked rice and a mixture of 6-row and 2-row. Does it usually mm-hmm. take a while for the Clarity Firm to work, or, you know, should I have expected it to go straight out of the fermenter, clear as a bell, right into the keg?
So the Clarity Firm, its purpose is to prevent protein haze, mm-hmm. and it happens. It should happen pretty quickly. I mean, when we make it in house, how long does he lager it? Like 4 to 6, 4 or 5 weeks. He actually lagers ours for at least 3 weeks, and hopefully longer if we can. Mm-hmm. And when it kegs it, it's pretty darn clear.
Mm-hmm.
It's delicious. It's way better. I used an enzyme once called Hazity Firm. It just didn't work as well. It was an off brand. I got it from Walmart. It just didn't work.
But you're trendy.
I am trendy. Yeah. I use it on the East Coast beers.
No, it's good. And I think, I don't know. I think my beer has been in the keg for like, 6 weeks maybe. So, you know, maybe that pairs up. you know, that I was, you know, I was wanting, I was wanting to be spectacular, you know, right out of the primary fermenter racking into the keg after like a week, you know?
Well, this might not have been due to protein.
It's that dirty equipment.
So how much does the Clarity Firm reduce gluten?
So we don't actually have the big bucks to test our beers, but if you go by the dosing that they recommend, it's under 20 parts per million, which is what's required to be considered not harmful to people with celiac.
Sure. Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yep. Now I do have a friend that he owns Neff Brewing here in Tulsa. Mm-hmm. That's 100% gluten-free beer. Mm-hmm. He doesn't start with any gluten grains. Mm-hmm. And he used the Clarity Firm a few times as a home brewer, and he still had issues from it. So it's
case by case.
It's a case by case, but he is he's ultra sensitive.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I think we had a conversation many years ago, and you were talking about you're so sensitive that if you can't go in the grain room essentially because the dust coming off of the grain mill can affect your skin, right?
It affects my skin, yeah. If I'm around the dust a lot, it'll definitely affect my skin.
Wow.
Perimeter alert.
Perimeter.
Right.
You can see where you've been. So Dave can hide your Christmas presents in there.
That's right.
It's a safe place.
Well, one of the topics that we want to talk about, and Steve brought this up the other day when we got together, is kind of like, you know, I think we all started homebrewing at about the same time. Steve and I started around 96, around there somewhere, and things were a whole lot different then. Plus, you know, we did this DVD commentary thing where we, you know, went along and looked at our first introduction to extract homebrewing DVD and, you know, kind of commented on how things have changed since then. But Desiree and Dave, when did y'all start homebrewing, and kind of give us a picture of what, you know, the state of homebrewing was back then as a hobby?
Well, I started perhaps in the early 90s, 91 or 2, and things were really taking off about that time. It was gaining popularity all across the country. Craft breweries were popping up everywhere. It was a hobby for a long time until about 2004. And we, after 20 years of IT, decided we'd had enough of that. And we're trying to come up with another idea to spend the next 20 years of our lives doing something completely different.
And here we are.
Homebrewing was still continuing to gain popularity for several years after we opened our business, where we had amazing growth year over year for several years. But I think all of the craft breweries that came out of that popped up everywhere. And now a lot of people used to make beer because it used to be more of a reason to make your own beer. It wasn't available.
Right.
Right.
Yep. That's very true.
And a lot of the home brewers are now commercial brewers.
Indeed.
Yes, indeedy.
Yeah. My best customers were all commercial brewer wannabes, and some of them became commercial brewers. But you know, by that, guys come in and brew 5-10 gallons every week. It's like, good Lord, how you can get through all that beer? And next thing I knew, you know, a year later, they're opening a brewery.
Yeah.
Right.
There were zero breweries in Tulsa, Oklahoma when we started in 04.
Yeah.
And now there's about 15 or so.
Wow.
And a couple in planning.
And back in the day, it seems like it was kind of an age of repurposing, because, you know, homebrewers had to take like soda pop kegs, you know, soda pop syrup kegs to make, you know, kegging equipment out of. They had to, you know, take beverage coolers to make mash tuns. They, you know, some of them, you know, illegally repurposed commercial, you know, kegs. to make keg cookers, you know, to use as kettles, and using, you know, burners that were either, you know, used for turkey fryers or for, you know, Cajun cookers or whatever. And so it was kind of a handyman's or handy person's hobby back then, because you just kind of had to use stuff that you found.
Right. Mash tins or igloo coolers, you know.
Exactly. Exactly. Yep. And homemade, what do you call it? The things on the bottom,
bottom.
Yeah, the false bottoms or the
manifold.
Manifold. Yeah. That's the word. Thank you.
I built my first true mash tin. I built from a 40 or 60 gallon cooler. And I built a PVC manifold, you know, it was so jerry-rigged. It worked, but I eventually had to put a screen over it because I was just getting too much grain, you know, too many stuck sparges. But it was just as Rube Goldberg as you could get.
Right.
But it worked, you know. I mean, I made decent enough beer. That's the fun thing about homebrewing is, you know, I'm certain that my beer wasn't very good when I started, but it was drinkable. So you just kept, you know, you kept trying, you know. It wasn't like, oh God, nobody could drink this.
Well, there wasn't much good beer around to compare it to. So
no, there wasn't.
There's a lot of bad beer.
Yeah. When we first opened the homebrew store, like in Oklahoma, there was nothing. And the big beers, the beers that we bought a lot of were Pyramid Brewing, mm-hmm. and what was the other one? There was
There's Pete's Wicked Ale.
Pete's Wicked Ale.
Back in the day.
Yeah. That was kind of all you had in Sammy Adams. And that was kind of it in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we'd get the German, you know, the imports, whether from Germany or not, but they were always 8 years old and, you know, been on a container ship for 6 weeks.
In a green bottle.
In a green bottle. And
I remember up when we traveled recently, I had it was the first, my mind is gone. The Pilsner Urquell, the first Pilsner Urquell mm-hmm. that I'd had on tap. And I guess the previous one that I'd had was years earlier in the green bottle. And it was like, wow, this doesn't taste like a skunk's rear end.
Yeah.
So when did you, I mean, how long after you first started the homebrew store did things start to turn around as far as, you know, the equipment available, the ingredients available, or was it already starting to get good at that time?
I would say I would say 5 or 6 years into it is when we really started getting a wide variety of grains that you could purchase, and the hops really exploded around then. A lot of hop varieties, you know, became available after they had that hop crisis where, like, one of the factories burnt down.
Oh, yeah.
And then it was a scramble for a few years. But then after that, it just seems like every year there's, like, you know, three different hops you got to now try to keep track of every year.
Yeah. New experimental hops.
Yeah. All the time now.
I don't know if I'm like the rest of the homebrewing community, but I'm kind of getting new hop burnout.
Same.
I definitely am.
It's hard to keep up with. And, I would agree with that.
Well, and both as a, you know, as a former retailer, it was hard to keep up because, you know, they come out with some new variety of something, something, something from New Zealand, and you get four customers that wanted it, and then they'd buy 1 or 2 ounces, and you could never sell it again.
Right.
That's happened very a true. Bunch.
Yeah, right. It's just, a bunch too.
Yeah. And then as a home brewer, then as a home brewer, you know, it's like have a palate of ingredients that you know well and brew with those. So that's my way of brewing. So it's like I want to really get to know a particular ingredient. I like to play with that until I've really explored it completely. Well, if you're hopping all the time, you never really explore how that hop fits together. So I tend to stay with noble hops, or, you know, the American versions of those, like Chinook and, you know, Cascade. And
right.
And that's about where I'm kind of at these days. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, when something new comes out, you don't want to at least check it out. But I'm kind of burned out with all that. Yeah.
Are you seeing that amongst your customers as well? In Tulsa, what are they brewing? Are they brewing the next new thing, or are they coming back to their old standards?
We have all kinds of customers. We've got some that are always interested in the newest thing. They're looking for that bioengineered yeast to get more thiols, and they're looking for that newest hop varietal. But you know, like Steve said, it might be a handful of people that there might actually be interested in that new thing, and something that needs to be managed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's hard to be everything to everybody.
That's very true.
Yeah, we try to maintain a broad selection without a lot of depth, so that everything stays fresh and choices.
Yeah, I assume you have the flexibility to do that. I mean, Steve had a little bitty shop, it'd be interesting to, you know, compare and contrast your two strategies on doing that kind of a thing. Whereas, you know, if Steve bought like one or two bags of a specialty malt, you know, that might last for a long time. But you guys probably have a lot, you know, better turnover and can be a little bit more flexible along those lines.
That's probably true. And we also have a brewery that we can use things ourselves.
Right.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, I bought Black Prince or something like that. I tended to buy that in 10-pound bags just so that it wouldn't, you know, stale up on me.
Gotcha, yeah.
Yeah, we kind of have had the Weyermann Carafa series since the beginning, and people like name brand stuff and tend to ask for it by name. And so for that function, we do have Carafa 1, 2, and 3.
Now, see, I couldn't do that. I had to pick, I couldn't carry multiple brands of essentially the same thing.
Right.
So I would say teach, mentor, and coach my customers that, you know, that beer that you want to brew with Carafa 3, or, you know, you could also brew with black malt, or, you know, something that I hadn't stocked.
Right. Black Prince.
Black Prince, and show them that. And in fact, a lot of the brewing that I did in my shop or for my shop, when I would brew specifically to show off a specialty malt or, you know, something different or something new, maybe a new hop, maybe a new malt, just so that my customers would be able to experience it and go, oh, well, I don't have to have that Carafa 3. I can brew that beer with this. And that seemed to work pretty good, but it's a very high maintenance way to have to work.
Sure.
Yeah, we get a lot of grain people that come in and go, oh, buy our grain from us. And we're like, no one's asking for your grain.
So right, exactly.
You know, we're not going to bring you in just because you have great prices, because no one is asking for your grain.
We already have 6 different Pilsner malts.
Exactly.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
For that one guy. That one bag is for that one guy.
That one guy.
That's true.
Who buys 3 pounds a month. Well, what beer should we try next? I haven't sampled the whole can, by the way. I'm pacing myself. But
I would suggest the bitter.
The
extraordinary bitter.
Extraordinary.
The adventures of ordinary bitter.
The extraordinary adventures
ordinary bitter. Ordinary bitter.
Ooh. This is actually one of my favorite beer styles.
Me too. I love this beer style.
Me three. Yeah.
I'll fourth that. Oh, nice.
I think it comes from my fond memories. In 1984, I was in London and got gloriously drunk with a lawyer in a bar, and we were drinking bitter, you know, all night long, and that's such a great memory. And I honestly believe that's why I like the style so much, because it's just like one of my favorite hangovers of all time.
Was it at a place where it came off the beer engine?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Awesome. St. James's pub next to Charing Cross in London.
Love it.
That's awesome.
Free plug there. For
that is, yeah, right. That is such a good beer. Gosh.
I love this beer so much.
It pours
like
kind of a
all the time.
It pours kind of a dark copper. Mm-hmm. For some reason I thought bitter was like more porterish.
No,
I'm not familiar with the style.
So a bitter is a. So this is interesting. When you're in England, if it's on draft, they call it a bitter, and if it's in bottles, or they tend to call it a pale ale.
Oh,
So it's really, it's basically an English pale ale.
Yeah.
Oh, it's nice. It's got a nice bitey bitterness up front, but it's got this, like, on the back of the tongue, it's this lingering caramel note that's very subtle, but doesn't show up. And I'm drinking this probably too cold.
And I like it because it just kind of has this nice kind of bready, grainy character to it. Yep. And the hops and an ordinary bitter is actually not very bitter. I don't know why the Brits call these bitters, because they're really not that bitter.
Have you ever eaten English food?
Yeah, that's a good point. Very valid point there. Yeah.
I'm sure it's gotten better. this is 4.5% alcohol, so it's very sessionable.
Yep.
So I'm assuming it starts with, like, maybe Maris Otter, or, you know, like an English pale.
Yep, Maris Otter. We have some golden naked oats from Simpsons in there, which gives it adds a little bit to the character. Some special roast and some caramel, a very small amount of caramel malt in there. And Kent Goldings are the main hop that's in it.
Mm. Wow.
No, that's a super good beer. It's really got nice head retention. Mm-hmm.
I love the color. Just this bright amber hopper.
Yeah. So what's the hopping strategy? I assume it's leaning more on the bittering hops than, you know, the end of the boil.
Matter of fact, they're that's it. It's just bittering hops.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could drink. In fact, I have had several cans of it.
When we make this for the tap room, I bring a keg home. I always bring a keg home.
you were nice enough when y'all came to visit a few weeks ago. You were nice enough to bring this flat of beers, and I was like, "Wow, all right." And it was all I could do to save some for this tasting. So I shuffled some off to Steve's house, and then I hid the rest of them behind other things in the beer fridge.
I was a good boy. I had these beers and some others for other shows and such. And so my wife is like, "So you've got a lot of beer out there we could share for the holidays." And I'm like, "No, we'll go to the store."
Yeah. That's
also both of these that we've had so far are available as kits.
Nice. Yeah,
that's a good point. Now I've said in advertising, and I hope it's true, that you're having a tap room there on premise, gives you the ability to hone recipes and get customer feedback and all that, and then turn them into homebrew kits or tweak your homebrew kits with that feedback. Right. Is that true? Say it's true.
we have a lot of beers that were made for the tap room that were so popular they become kits. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I thought surely that's true, and yeah, it's true.
People really like that too. They can taste examples of this recipe at the homebrew store.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. When did you guys were a winery before you were a brewery, right?
Right. Yeah. We've been a winery for 15 years, 16 years. It was about 4 years after we opened the store. We got the winery license because we wanted to show off the wine kits. So, hey, you want to know what this wine tastes like? Buy a bottle of it. And then if you like it, you can make your own dirty bottles of it for a lot less money.
That's brilliant. Also a good way to go through kits.
True.
You can make them and sell them. But then once you had once you wanted to start the brewery, so you have a homebrew shop and a winery and a brewery all basically under the same roof and a tap room.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the legal, living in Oklahoma, and talk about the legal exercises that you had to go through to make all that happen at once.
It was a challenge when we moved to our latest location. That's when we decided to add the brewery, because it was set up in a way that we could have a tap room. There was some separation there, so you could have a tap room that felt like it was not part, like you were sitting in the middle of a homebrew store, right? And the first thing that had to happen was we had to rezone the entire shopping center to allow light industrial manufacturing. So that was about a 4-month process. Took us about four months to get that done. So we had to do that. And then the second thing is, a company can have a winery and a brewery, but they can't be the same address and they can't be in the same location. And, but luckily, just by luck, seriously, it was just luck. I made a joke. Hey, I wonder if we can have a brewery and a winery at the same place. And we had two entrances to our store, and one said 146 over the door and the other one said 144. So I said, hey, I'll just put 144 as the brewery because the winery is 146. And it was a good thing that I did that.
Yeah. Yeah, because you're taking up two spaces.
Yeah. Right, yeah. There. And we also had to have our lease redone because we had to have separate leases. So 3 months into 3 months into having this new location, we had to call the landlord and go, hey, can we redo our lease to make it two different leases? So, yeah. The laws are stupid in every state. Every state has their stupid laws, but this one is really bad. I had to have separate books. You have to have separate everything, even though we're really, it's the same company, really.
But it's better. It's better than when you first started.
Yes, absolutely.
Because I think back when I first started the podcast, I think that there were five states where homebrewing was still technically illegal. And I think Oklahoma was one of those.
We were one of them. Yes, we were. Yeah.
So we've come a long way, baby.
Come a very long way. Yeah, and it was 4 years after we opened our homebrew store. Marshall Brewing opened their brewery, which was the first one in the, you know, modern era, I guess you would say, to be open in Tulsa and in the current area era. And yeah, they didn't know what to do. They didn't. I mean,
they couldn't operate a tasting room.
They couldn't even have a tasting room.
They had to give away samples.
They had to get, yeah. And then at one point they just closed the room, the sampling room completely because they were too paranoid that they were going to break some law and get a big fine. Wow, so they wouldn't even serve samples.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
But they were instrumental in getting the laws changed.
They were, yeah.
And I remember, Steve, you and I went to Krebs. Is it Krebs uh-huh. Brewing? And
Krebs Brewing, yeah. It's basically Prairie Ales now.
Right, right. Yeah. In McAllister, right? Yeah. And it's right yeah. next door in the same building as Pete's Place.
So that's their old location. The old brewery was co-located there with Pete's Place. The new brewery is actually, and that was in Krebs.
Right.
The new brewery is in McAllister, and it's big.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Well, I remember that was like the best free lunch I think I'd ever had.
Right.
We yeah, did the interview there and they fed us for free at the Italian place. But my point of bringing them up was, you know, they basically shared the building, but they had to put a door between, you know, the brewery and the restaurant. And they couldn't like just yeah. like take kegs from the brewery to the restaurant. They had to sell kegs right. to a distributor. And then the distributor right. had to sell the beer to the restaurant.
Yep.
I guess it's to make sure that the
distributor had to take possession of the kegs right. to bring them over to the restaurant.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
It's nuts. But like you said, the alcohol laws are crazy probably everywhere in some way or another.
It's been very significant in Oklahoma over the last few years. I mean, rapid changes. 3-2 is now gone. We're a full strength state, and you can self distribute if you want. You don't have to go through a distributor. So there's been a lot of improvements.
Yeah. So
you know, Oklahoma.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say Oklahoma is an interesting state to me in that, as a state, it's such a conservative state, and yet. There are more medical marijuana dispensaries than anywhere else in the country. The beer
it's
laws.
It's the Wild West with the dispensaries.
It really is, yeah. And so it's just interesting how it has opened up, you know, and gotten so much better from our point of view.
Yes. Yep.
But it's
I agree.
But it's because of people, you know, like you know Marshall Brewing and y'all, and it's because of people kind of putting pressure on. Legislators mm-hmm. to say, look, you know, this is a business. And this is not, you know, the laws are not business friendly right now, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
That's the angle.
That is the absolute angle you have to take when you're talking to them.
Look at all that tax money you're missing.
Yeah, no kidding.
Can't be anti-business.
Yeah. Well, speaking of anti-business, it's dry January. So dry January, I mean, you know, good to everybody, you know, kudos to everybody who's trying to, you know, make sure that they have control of everything in their lives and, you know, taking a month to kind of examine yourself, so to speak, is probably a good thing. But you're probably hoping that people just don't all do it all at once, right?
I guess.
Well, but see, the thing is, you can have dry January as long as you have foamy February.
Hey, foamy February.
Yeah, there you got to brew in January in order to have foamy February.
I liked it.
We're going to use that.
We'll give you credit for that.
You can have it.
That's great.
Dry January is tough. And I don't know if it's happening in Arkansas, but a lot of the breweries, they go out of their way to come up with a lot of non-alcoholic alternatives. So you guys still come to the tap room and
I bet that's true. But you know, that brings up a new topic.
Oh.
And that's brewing goals. One of my brewing goals is to learn how to and hopefully get good at it of brewing low gravity beers, because they are becoming very popular. And just as an overall, I just can't, you know, me personally, I can't handle the alcohol like I used to, getting of that age. And so, you know, if I could learn to brew a really tasty 2-3 even 4%, but that's getting normal, you might say. That's a goal. That's something I want to kind of learn. And James has done quite a few brews down in the, you know, 2-2.5% range that were very good. So that's a place that I'm heading, and so that just kind of ties into that dry January of kind of learning you can still brew, but you can back off those 8-9% beers and learn to brew a 2-4% beer that's still very satisfying, and stay in the game.
Would you call that damp January?
Yeah,
I call it. Right. I call it moist January.
Oh, he said it.
See, I know people. It's a reason why. It's a reason why I say that word. It's because people have an aversion to it. But anyway, because I'm a jerk. I'm a jerk.
That word.
But you, Desiree, you have a hopped tea that you make.
That's right. Yes.
That's zero alcohol and zero calories too. I think
zero calorie. Yes. Yeah. The most popular one that we make is we call it lemon drop. It uses lemon drop hops in it. And we use Assam black tea. And Assam black tea, one of the main flavor descriptors is malty.
Oh.
So I zoned in on that particular tea. And we use monk fruit to back sweeten it, because there's other hop companies out there that make hop teas. But they've always felt very harsh and hard to drink to me. And so I wanted to put some sweetness in there so that it would feel more balanced. So monk fruit is a really great way to do that, because there's no calories involved.
Now, what is it? Did you say monk fruit?
Monk fruit. So it's one of the newfangled, you know, calorie-free sugar substitutes that's out there. Monk fruit is like, that's the name of the fruit. It's monk fruit. Mm-hmm. And then there's another thing, one of the talls, you know, the xylitol, one of the talls,
sugar alcohol.
One of the sugar alcohols
is
used with it. So it's a one-to-one measurement of sugar, compared to sugar. And we don't want to make it taste like a sweet tea. We just want to make it balanced. Right. So we add just enough of the monk fruit so that it feels like you're drinking a beer. And it actually looks like a beer when you pour it.
Mm-hmm.
It's awesome. It has a head on it. It's the color of beer, and it's very tasty, and really helps people feel like they're, you know, not being isolated when they're hanging around with people that are drinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great idea. And every time we go visit you, we come back with a 4-pack of it. So yeah, it's good.
This year, we really want to try to focus on that and maybe get a broader distribution of it, kind of get the word out that this thing exists, because everyone that tries it loves it so much. It's just trying to make people aware that we have it.
Are you working on other like Steve, you know, said, like lower gravity or lower alcohol alternatives for those who are trying to cut down a little bit on their alcohol intake?
Not really, but most of the beers that we brew are around 5%. You know, I'd say between, you know, 4.5 to 6% is our range. And then we'll have a couple of high, you know, higher alcohol beers on tap, but we try not to make a whole lot of high alcohol beers already, but we've not really attempted to go much below like 4%.
Yeah, that's getting pretty, I mean, I would absolutely agree that that's getting pretty extreme, but it's an, I have just anecdotally, you know, my son and his friends, and they're 27, 28 years old, and they're all moving either to no calorie or low calorie drinks, or they're drinking cocktails.
Yeah.
And so they're just kind of moving away from I think what I'm hearing mostly is an anti-hop thing. They're kind of like, I'm just tired of IPAs. I'm tired of that heavy hop thing.
We used to have like 4 to 6 IPAs on tap all the time now, but all the time. And now we're like at 3. Yeah. Well, 3, maybe 4 out of our 12 taps now.
We're down to 3 or 4.
3 or 4 out of 12 taps. But it used to be like, you know, 4 or 5 of the 12 taps were hops.
Yeah.
Sometimes even 6. And now it's like 3, 4. We rarely have more than 4.
Yeah.
To make a flight of IPA.
What do you do, like a West Coast, an East Coast, a hazy?
Yep. We have a West Coast style. We have a East Coast style or hazy. I guess that's one and the same. And then we tend to, and we have one that we call a mid-coast
or
Midwest. It's it's kind of a more bittering than the East Coast style, but not as bitter as a West Coast style. So it's a blending of the two. Probably what you would have called an IPA 15 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe just and just a pale ale today.
Yeah.
It's coming around. It's coming back around.
And the thing is, if part of the game is also marketing. Mm-hmm. And so if you can slap the word India in front of it, for a long time, that would sell. Like, just call it an IPA. It'll sell.
That's true. And what's really funny is I really dislike the term IPA. I think we should take ownership of all these great new beers that we've come up with in the United States and, you know, call it an American hoppy beer, hoppy ale.
I agree completely.
It's come up with something different because we've come up with these styles. The U.S. has. And we should own that and quit calling them IPAs.
Yeah. IPAs.
Soapbox. I bet you're coined phrases. So.
Yeah, it's become IPAs become meaningless. You know, there's so
it
many
doesn't mean anything.
So many abbreviations that are just letters that don't mean the same thing as what they used to.
I mean,
we have a black one.
We have a black IPA, a black pale ale.
It's a Cascadian dark ale.
Seriously, folks.
But you have an example of this.
Yeah. It's in our stuff to drink today.
Well, and the other one is a white stout.
Yes.
I
think we should drink the stout before we drink the Black Cat's IPA.
Okay.
Because the Black Cat's IPA is a double black IPA, so won't be able to taste the aggression very well if you.
This aggression will not stand, man.
Yeah.
This has been a really popular beer for us.
So we're moving on to that one now.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
We brewed it for a screening of The Big Lebowski.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Desiree and I had never seen it.
Oh, wow.
And this was only like 4 years ago.
Oh, 5 years ago now.
Something like that. Yes. They go by quick these
days.
They
do go so quick.
Yeah.
Sunrise, sunset.
And all we knew is there was a character in the movie called The Dude, and he liked White Russians. And so we brewed a White Russian-themed beer for the screening. And it's turned out to be one of our most popular beers.
It's basically been on tap ever since. We were just brewing it for this event. So you know, come watch The Big Lebowski with Dave and Desiree, who for some reason have never seen this movie. And it's a great beer.
It smells like a stout. I think we've talked about this beer on the show before, but it's worth revisiting just because it's so fun. It looks like quite a Pilsner looking, but it's like a pale ale kind of
color. The golden ale.
Yeah. Oh, perfect. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you smell
it's delicious.
You smell it, and it smells like a stout.
Yeah, see, I know, and a lot of people, oh, this is gimmicky, and I'm like, isn't everything gimmicky? I mean, come on, we call everything an IPA.
Oh, my God.
So basically, the idea is you make it taste like a stout and smell like a stout, but then it's this really clear, pretty beer, and
yeah,
and it's amazing.
Like very, very good homage to a White Russian, I think.
Yeah, it's super, it's chocolatey, mm-hmm. And it's a, is it a milk stout? I mean, is there?
Yes, there is some lactose in it, and then we have a local roaster, Double Shot, we get the coffee beans from them. We, mm-hmm. for the longest time, we used their cold pressed coffee, but we just recently switched to just using the beans, and then we add vanilla. So it's a lactose, coffee, beans, and vanilla.
Huh. Into a golden ale.
So you get the stout characteristics from coffee.
Yep, coffee and yep.
That's amazing. It tastes like it's got, you know, chocolate malt and, you know, all the darker malts that go into making, you know, a stout or a porter. But then it's, you know, it's clear and it's golden and it's got a little bit of sweetness. It's not too sweet.
Right. Yeah. We put in the lactose because, you know, a White Russian has the cream in it. So mm-hmm. we thought, oh, well, but it'll be like, so I guess technically it's a white cream stout.
Huh.
A white cream stout.
A coffee cream ale.
Yeah.
And you've never had this beer, right, Steve?
No, not till this moment. It's lovely. I really like it a lot.
I love watching people's reaction when they taste it for the first time. And if they don't say something like, wow, I'm disappointed.
Yeah, I get it. When it finishes with that kind of roastiness that you expect from a stout. But I'm wondering if that comes, how am I going to say this? If that comes from hops or comes from grain. In other words, I'm tasting what I would expect to come from a dark burnt malt.
Right, right.
It does have bitterness, and that comes from the Warrior hops.
Okay, there you go. That's what, yeah. Because that bittering charge at the end is pronounced, but it takes the place of that kind of burnt toast thing.
And this is really a nice. This is a kit too.
That's right.
Yeah, we have this as a kit as well.
Wow.
So how do you handle the coffee?
So once the fermentation is complete, we take coffee beans and throw them in the fermenter.
Uncracked. Mm-hmm. Just whole beans?
Yep.
Just whole beans. We did a couple of test runs because we didn't want to. So when we turned it into a kit, we didn't want to have the cold press coffee because it didn't have the shelf life that we needed. Mm. So I did a couple of experiments with the beans, and we kind of took a, you know, like a hammer mallet and bashed them up and put it in a keg. And then we took one where it was just whole beans, and mashing it up just gave us a lot of particulate in the beer and didn't really mm-hmm. make it that much better. So we just went with the whole beans.
And it would seem like if you crack the beans or if you ground the beans in any way, pardon me, you would risk darkening the beer as well.
That's very true. Yeah. I hadn't really considered that part, but yeah.
So we're just dry beaning.
We're dry beaning, yeah.
Dry Java-ing. It's great. It's not like it doesn't taste like a coffee beer to me, which is crazy. And maybe it's all just, you know, suggestion, the power of suggestion. Maybe I'm expecting to taste a stout.
Smoke and mirrors.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah,
it'd be great to blindfold somebody and have them drink this.
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
have them guess what the style is.
Yeah.
That would be fun.
Yeah. That's another kind. Yeah. That's another kind of tasting event at your tap room.
That's a show.
Blindfolded.
So what?
Name that. I can name that beer in three sips.
Well, that actually would be a fun show.
That would be a fun show.
And, yeah, and we'd throw it away because we'd be so bad at it. So.
It's like when I used to play drums when I was stoned. Gee, I'm good. You'd hear it and go, oh, God.
Yeah, until you heard the recording later.
Exactly.
Sounded great at the time. Mm-hmm.
Well, what trends or what goals should we think of in 2024 to keep? Because I take it that homebrewing is, if the attendance at HomebrewCon for the past couple of years is any indication, homebrewing, interest in homebrewing has slackened a bit. Is that what you're seeing, or what do you think people should concentrate on that are still in the hobby to kind of keep them interested in the hobby? What are some trends or goals that you see for 2024?
Because there's definitely been a decline in the homebrewing world, and I kind of equate it to two things. Well, for Oklahoma anyway, in Oklahoma, if you wanted to brew the beer you liked. If you wanted to drink the beer you like, you had to brew it because you weren't getting it here. Mm-hmm. And then all the breweries started opening up and all that, and good beer started getting, distributed into Oklahoma. And these people that were brewing beer strictly because they couldn't get the beer they liked went, oh, hallelujah, I don't have to brew beer anymore. And they stopped. Mm-hmm. And then you also have, cannabis. So, So there's other alternatives now outside of, beer, alcohol. That has also contributed to the decline. So now you just have the people that really want a hobby. Like they like the tinkering and they like the playing with it, and trying to keep them engaged is really a challenge.
Well, I think that appealing to the foodie aspect of the hobby, might be a good thing to do. I mean, I'm, I love to cook. Steve and I both love to cook. And so to me, cooking is not a chore. It's fun. And, coming up with different flavors and things like that. And so in that way, homebrewing is not, it's not a chore to me. It's fun because mm-hmm. I get to taste, what I come up with afterwards. And, there's
exactly.
experimental and, so it's not just, like cooking is not just cooking to eat. Brewing is not just brewing to drink, because you said, there's good beer. Just down the street, so maybe sparking people's interest from a culinary or culinary angle would be something to do.
It's funny you say that. We had a couple from Colorado come in on Christmas Eve, actually, and they specifically came in there because they wanted to do a beer kit. And that was what most of the discussion was. This is like a recipe. You guys like to cook. Oh, we love to cook. And I said, well, you're going to love brewing beer then because it's cooking and it's playing with ingredients and it's having fun with it. So that's it. I agree. That's a good angle. And we really should use that more than we do.
I say, if you like washing dishes, you'll love home brewing, but
there you go. That's
right. Well, Dave cleans up for me, so I don't experience that. So I just seem like, I mean, everything is just magically taken care of after I brew.
But I don't do laundry. So.
I still wash the dishes, but Susan rinses. So, it's.
I have to say, I am encouraged by attendance in our introductory beer workshop that we do on the last Saturday of each month.
Oh.
We had a really good attendance last time, and we've already got a pretty good class lining up for the end of January. And so that indicates some renewed interest in brewing. Trends don't go the same direction forever. And we've seen several years of decline. And, young folks are getting a day older every day.
Yep.
We can't write them all off. Some of them are going to be creative, fun individuals that want to take up the mantle and explore the world of brewing.
And things are cyclic or cyclic. Anyway, I have some beer, but things do come around, and what inspires the previous generation, necessity to brew to get good beer, that changes, and now you know, maybe people, whether it's a curiosity about the process or whether they like to cook and they want to try new flavors, or, you know, if whatever's bringing people into the store, whatever's bringing people into your workshops, you know, I think that's encouraging. I think, you know, that's something that we can be inspired by going forward.
We've also seen a renewed interest in mead.
Mead is really picking up.
I guess there's a TikTok video out there too. show people making a 1 gallon batch of mead, and we've got young kids coming all the time wanting to get set up for mead, but 1 gallon at a time.
Yeah, I sold a ton of those little 1 gallon, both 1 gallon ingredient kits, and then I had a little 1 gallon, you know, equipment kit, and boy, those things just flew off the shelves.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, Grownfell, to mention another sponsor, Grownfell is, you know, selling both 1 gallon and 5 gallon equipment and ingredients.
That's right. I heard that the last podcast I was listening to, you mentioned that. I thought that's great. That's a great idea for them.
Yeah, yeah, and it's at least the one I got, the 1 gallon veneer kits, really reasonably priced. You know, it's really, really good honey. So anyway, and I you know, I'm giving them a plug, but we love them. We love
y'all. I'm pretty sure they won't ship to Oklahoma, so I can't try their stuff. So,
well, I don't know. They ship to Arkansas.
So for Oklahoma, you have to like purchase a distribution license to be able to send it into Oklahoma legally, and it's expensive enough that if they don't feel like they're going to get enough sales, they're not going to mess with that.
But they might be able to sell. Well, you can get the ingredients. I was going to say you could buy an equipment kit you've already got all that stuff. I need another beer. What are we going? Where are we going next?
Do you want to do the Black Cats?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do the Black Cats.
Black Cats IPA.
And then there's the Roughneck Black Lager.
Oh, well, so we don't have a Roughneck here, but if you guys want to open the Roughneck.
No, let's save it because I don't want to. I've got these lovely beers open that I can't drink all of them. Right. So I don't want to open anything we're not going to be able to finish.
Yeah, this may be our last beer on Mike. So just so like you say, we don't waste any good beer.
Yeah, I was telling my wife I got these out, and I went, "Oh God, these are whole pint pours." I said, "I don't want to open these because I can't drink them all in one sitting."
Well, you could pretend you're still recording and keep the door shut.
Yes, that's right.
She'll never know.
She'll never know until she picks me up for DWI in my own room.
Walking from your
that's right.
Walking from your studio into the kitchen. Okay, yeah. this is the Black Cat's Eye PA. Cheers, y'all.
It's hard coming up with names. It's really hard.
Oh, that's good. That's really good. Now it's
lovely
interesting.
Head.
I'm getting more roasty character from the golden beer than
the Black Cats.
Yeah, I am too.
So the Black Cats IPA, it's like it's about 74-ish% pale ale malt, and then we've got 10% of it's
Munich,
light Munich. Mm-hmm. And then 7% of it is a caramel malt, and then the rest of it is chocolate malt and chocolate wheat.
That's nice.
It's sort of the grain bill of a porter with the hot bill of
an IPA.
West Coast IPA.
Yeah, West Coast, yeah.
And it may be the bitterness and the hops that are scrubbing off, you know, those roasty characters.
Rounding
them off. So yeah, this has Amarillo, Citra, Columbus and Simcoe in it.
Wow.
Yeah. It's way good. I'm getting all those American hops. I'm getting
really hop forward still.
But they don't, it's hop forward, but it's not hop overwhelming.
Right. It really plays well on the tongue.
Yeah.
Now it's I get, even maybe it's a combination of all those hops, I get a little bit of mint in there somewhere. And it may be just the, you know, all the beers that I've
that I've tasted up until this time, but it's.
I see what you mean. I think
you need to spit that gum out.
Yeah, it's a double mint.
Got some double mint gum going.
It might be the effect of all the hops together. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like they're all combining together or working, you know, with each other to create this. And maybe it's, you know, the combination between the malt and everything. It's not a predominant. I'm standing on the top of a mountain with a, you know, peppermint patty or anything, but there's just a teeny bit of a note of mint in there.
I think I'd characterize it more as woody, but.
Yeah. All these,
I'm not going to say it.
All these jokes.
Yeah, I'm not going to.
I'm getting a woody.
That's a number one, a number three, and a number seven.
I was going to say, I'm being nice. There's a lady present. We have to be. But then, her husband came out with it. So there you go.
That's I see what you mean, though, James. But yeah, I kind of get the woodiness, but I get a little. I get the mint. Okay. I just walked right into that. Didn't
you?
I
really like that beer. Yeah.
You really, really like that beer.
It was hard, but now it's much softer.
Notice I'm stepping back. I'm stepping
back.
Yeah,
you may want to cut that out.
No, it's good. It's good. It's not. I've had some of this style that are really kind of harsh.
Mm-hmm.
The bitterness from the hops and bitterness from the dark malts, you know, that roasty kind of almost astringent kind of character kind of clash. And, you know, it's one and one plus three on that side of things.
Right.
But this is not that way at all. It's very, I haven't said
it's
balanced.
It's very tricky
yet.
Making black IPAs. The vast majority I've had have been not very well balanced. Mm-hmm. I would say Marshall Brewing here in Tulsa has their El Cucuy, which is a black IPA. And it's one of the few others that I really enjoy drinking.
Yeah.
You like your own.
I do absolutely like our own. I mean, other than ours.
So what's the hopping strategy? Do you hop it just like a regular IPA?
So this one actually does have some bittering hops. The Columbus is the bittering hop for this. And then the rest of it is basically whirlpool and dry hopping.
Hmm. It's good. It's way good. Now we haven't talked about your system. Talk about this. You're running electric, of course, in your brewery, but talk about your setup, you know, your capacity and, you know, go geek out. Dave on your, or Desiree, whoever, I'm assuming Dave wants to talk about it more, but that's just me being a.
he is the guy who builds them.
Well, yeah, a couple of years ago, we outgrew our one barrel system and we got a 3.5 barrel system from Blickman, but I did build our own controller for it. And we can squeeze out 5 barrel batches and we do have 5 barrel fermenters. And so a lot of times, sometimes we'll do that for a low gravity beer. But Tim, my son-in-law, likes to brew around 2.5 barrels at a time. So he'll often brew the first half of a beer on day one and the second half of the beer on day two and pitch it on top of the already fermenting first half.
Ah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, wow, yeah. Would you describe it as a tradition, is it more of a homebrew system or is it more of a commercial brewing system as far as...
It's a commercial brewing system, but it's a two-vessel configuration. There are 3 6,000-watt elements in the kettle. And during the mash, the wort is slowly recirculated through the kettle like a two-vessel system typically does. The temperature in that large volume doesn't really drop during a one-hour mash. And so we don't worry too much about that. Like you would in a smaller system, you'd have more heat loss.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a cool setup. And it's, if you go to the homebrew store, you can, or the tap room, you know, you can walk around, you can wander around in there between the two addresses and
brewery tour.
Yeah. You can get an official tour. But it's whatever y'all are doing, you know, be sure to tell, you know, tell Tim our kudos, because, you know, all of these beers are super clean and delicious and, you know, very impressive. So, you know, your many years of brewing background and building equipment and all that stuff, it's paying off, because, you know, and I think the recipes, you know, these aren't beers that I could, you know, usually find around here. You know, your diverse recipe selection, you know, for your beers, it seems like that you guys have a lot of imagination. I mean, you're even selling a pickle beer, for goodness sake. So
that pickle beer is stupid popular.
We tried to make it seasonal, but people complained.
Wow.
Give the people what they want.
That's true. It's not what you want. It's what they want. Yeah.
But it is good. Surprisingly good.
Yeah, I will admit it's a good beer. I mean, I used to drink pickle juice as a kid, so.
I did too.
Yeah.
We drink a little pickle
definitely
juice.
Fits that bill.
Well, this has been fun. You know, it's a good way to start off 2024. Just, you know, tasting beers and having fun with friends. And for those of y'all who are enjoying dry January out there, you know.
Don't forget about foamy February.
Foamy February is coming up.
I like it.
All right, Desiree and Dave, thanks as always for your friendship and your support throughout the years. One of my favorite things is of this whole thing is getting to know people and becoming good friends with them. And that's certainly the case with y'all.
Same. We Thank feel the you. Same. Thank you.
Thank you. I have to say, yes, we are very privileged to know all the people we know in the beer world because of beer and brewing.
Thanks as always, Steve, for joining in the fun. And I hope this wasn't too much of an imposition.
Never. Always a privilege.
Happy New Year, y'all.
Happy New Year.
Well, thanks again, as always, to Desiree and Dave and to Steve. Be sure to check out highgravitybrew.com for the kits of the beers that we tasted. It would be a wonderful way to head into foamy February. And don't forget about the new discount code for highgravitybrew.com. BB10, that's BB10, will get you 10% off beer ingredients. That includes everything you see under the beer ingredients menu on highgravitybrew.com. Enter BB10 at checkout or go to basicbrewing.com and click on the High Gravity ad on the right-hand side, and the code will be entered automatically. The code isn't available with the other offers, but it's a good one. That's BB10 for 10% off beer ingredients at highgravitybrew.com. That's highgravitybrew.com. And if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. Please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. It's all until next time. Till then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.